You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock.
Now, I think I'm pretty typical of a Brit, James. I think I like to think I can pick a winner. We are at heart in Britain a gambling nation, and we're also pretty pragmatic. I think that's very important in an election year.
Well, the lottery tickets come out in my family every Christmas, Caroline. And I mean, the numbers stack it up. Gambling is a big British industry. Election years, I guess everyone is trying to pick the winner. Certainly a lot of the business lobbies who are engaging with political parties going into this.
But so too, the Bayes Business School. This, of course, is relevant because we get the Mays Lecture today. If you've never heard of it, it's a very important speech that is given usually to somebody quite interesting.
Yes, I mean, you see Mark Carney on the guest list, Volcker, the famous US central bank head, and an interesting Tony Blair in 1995. And this is an interesting quirk of the lecture. It often seems to be someone who is setting an economic agenda. Just take a listen to this relatively unknown chancellor. You might have heard of him giving it 2 years ago.
I am optimistic about the future of this country and people's desire to do things differently. We must put all our energies into three priorities: capital, people, ideas. And if we can do that, then we can rejuvenate our national productivity, restore hope and opportunity as we level up, and have confidence in our future happiness, prosperity, and security.
Yes, of course, back then, Rishi Sunak was the moment, and he still might be in this coming election. But just to give you some of the popularity ratings, in November 2021, a few months before he gave that lecture, on the Conservative Home website, he had a favourable rating with his own voters, Conservative voters, of 53.3. Dishy Rishi, big furlough scheme, yes. Handing out the cash. Now, if you go to February's rating last month, his Conservative Home readers and people who vote in their poll gave him a rating of -18.4. And that is a bit of a fall, Caroline.
It's an enormous drop. And that's why I think the Mays Lecture is so very interesting, isn't it? Because it picks people, it would seem, heavyweight politicians and economic thinkers. I mean, Mark Carney's given one of these lectures, and Mervyn King, and as you say, Paul Volcker, and so many others. But Rishi Sunak, he was setting out a major vision. This was pandemic Britain, remember? And he came up with, he and his team, something totally new. I think because the popularity has dipped so dramatically for him as Prime Minister, we sometimes forget that. But this Mays lecture does seem to pick people who are perhaps at the pinnacle of their vision, V for vision.
We need, I think the Labour team would write in at this point and ask us to have a swear jar for the word, the V word, vision, because they have come under a lot of criticism. Keir Starmer reportedly hates it because they are trying to be concerned with practicality. And yet, we are going to be sort of very interested to see if the Mays Lecture have picked a winner with Rachel Reeves and vision later today.
Yeah, absolutely. So Reeves, what is she going to set out? She wants to be Britain's first female chancellor. How much is she going to be able to talk about the economic plans that Labour has? They've been so very tight-lipped about it. But this is a big forum in which to give this lecture. I wonder also if she'll bring up things that the City of London are most interested in, things like, you know, saving more, investing more, getting more returns for your money. I mean, the UK has been very concerned about this, about stock markets, how to improve the FTSE 100. Just this morning, I was speaking to a big US firm, Robinhood, that's coming to the UK with a new app. It's commission-free trading, and they're basically trying to replicate what has been a huge success in the US here in the UK. And it means that people in the UK can get access to thousands of US listed stocks. So I was speaking just earlier to Robinhood's UK president, Jordan Sinclair, about why they're coming to the UK.
And the long-term investor is ultimately who we're targeting here in the UK. And I think what we've shown in the US and what we'll do the same here is we can provide access for a lot of customers that it may be their first trade or their first investment and be on that journey with them.
Yeah.
But also the long-term investor who's saving for retirement or buying a house, which are actually the number two reasons UK investors were interested in investing. I found in the last 6 to 9 months, and you guys contribute to it, some news about retail investing. British media are not always that positive, so maybe a bit of a mix, but people are talking about it. The Chancellor's talking about it. It's in the headlines. So I do think there's a nice groundswell, and if customers can participate and kind of join that wealth accumulation opportunity that perhaps in the previous generations was reserved for the rich or the wealthy, we'd like to help them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a real idea, certainly in the Square Mile in the City of London, about there being a need for more risk-taking in order to build wealth. I mean, as you say, the Chancellor with the Mansion House reforms, what about, you know, funneling some of the money from Robinhood into UK stocks? Is that pressure that you're feeling?
It's not pressure we're feeling, but it's a customer need that they've told us, and I think that's the way to build your business, what's important to them. Things like tax wrappers, things like local stocks, we've heard loud and clear, and it's on us to build a great local product, not just launch a product and be done. It's what comes next, and that's on us. Build a great product, keep iterating, and if local stocks are top of mind, that's absolutely something we'll think about.
So that was Jordan Sinclair, who is the UK president of Robinhood, which is this new app. Look, the UK has so many economic issues that it has to deal with. I'm just going to be fascinated to hear what the shadow chancellor actually plans to do about it.
But there are a lot of pluses, Carol. I mean, look, you know, small tech companies, crypto enthusiasm. I was fascinated to hear kind of people sort of wanting to go from crypto maybe into sort of app trading stocks. We are a nation of savers, famously. And so it will be fascinating to see how this tech optimism, how far it does or doesn't play into what Reeves has to say later and her vision for the economy.
Yeah, look, I definitely think it is a vote of confidence, right? Robinhood is going to use the UK as its launch platform, you know, to get into Europe. That wealth creation idea, I mean, surely that gets a cheer from anybody in the UK that's suffered from such a difficult 15 years where actually incomes haven't grown very much. So if people can get, you know, make their pound work harder, as Jordan Sinclair was saying, maybe that's a good thing.
Let's get a read then on Rishi Sunak's economic hopes now with our Bloomberg economics reporter, Tom Rees. Tom, so we just heard there an extract from Rishi Sunak's May's lecture. Feels like a long time ago now. Rachel Reeves is due to give hers later today. Is the fact that she was picked to give this big lecture a sign that the balance of power is shifting to Labour?
I think so. You know, the May's lecture is often, you know, used to set out a big economic vision by politicians, and you only have to look at the list of previous speakers to kind of see its importance. You know, we had Nigel Lawson in 1984 before, you know, as he was setting out the Big Bang, transforming the economy then. You had George Osborne in 2010, shortly before the era of austerity. But Labour sports
might be... It feels almost like this is like the economic version of the Sun, in that they always pick the winners.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe they could just see the writing on the wall. But yeah, maybe for Labour sports, they'd be, you know, happy to know that Tony Blair gave it in 1995. Before his landslide victory a few years later. So it's definitely one of those moments where a politician can lay out their vision for the economy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Labour will be hoping that lands. I suppose the issue, though, is Rishi Sunak only this week was trying to focus on the economy and point to some of the successes, and it turned out to be a very, very short speech.
To be honest, he probably doesn't get, you know, a lot of credit for what he's done in terms of stabilising the economy, but it doesn't really feel, other than tax cuts, it doesn't really feel we have a grand vision from the Tory party. And I wonder whether that's just because it's so divided. It's quite hard to kind of get a consensus on a vision from them. You know, they can't agree on things like planning reforms. The trust tax cuts obviously didn't work. But we have seen a lot of, you know, the damage that the trust government did, you know, sort of reverse, you know, in terms of gilt yields and mortgage rates. And Sunak did stabilise things, but the economy is, you know, far from roaring. And we only had figures last month, you know, showing that we were in a very mild recession in the second half of last year. So I'm not sure it'd be the best electoral strategy to fight on the economy, given the turbulence we've had over the last couple of years.
But then, so we talk about vision, and in some ways, I think the Labour Party get away with quite a lot in terms of vision, because we know there are these five big missions that Keir Starmer talks about. And we also know that, you know, reportedly that Keir Starmer hates the V word for vision. Everyone, because the polls are so much in Labour's favour, want to know what Labour will do. Do you think we will find out today? And Tom, like, you cover this stuff in a lot more detail than we do. What details do we know so far about what Labour would achieve if they were to win office?
Well, the funny thing is that the very few details that we've had, you know, in terms of what they might do to raise, what taxes they might raise to kind of generate a bit of money to boost public spending. We saw Jeremy Hunt nick in the budget earlier this month. So to be fair to them, what details they have put out that have been stolen. But you're right, that they haven't set out a huge program of a very specific reforms or, you know, tax rise or spend rise, etc. But I think maybe that's to be expected, given that we're still probably some couple of, well, we get the election in the autumn. So maybe we'll get more details. But I think what Reeves, the preview of the speech we were getting from Reeves today, what she's trying to set out is a bit of a vision. She's trying to set herself against the last couple of Tory governments by, you know, promising stability, which she says can help deliver business investment and growth, and by ensuring the strength of Britain's institutions. You know, let's remember, you know, the trust government damaged those by trying to sideline the OBR and the Bank of England. But I thought what was really interesting, that, you know, the trails of the speech that we got overnight is she's also promising big supply side reforms to deliver investment, you know, such as planning reforms to make it easier to build. And she even kind of likened it to a moment that Margaret Thatcher faced in 1979, you know, when she came in to deliver some quite radical reforms to revive the British economy. I'm not sure whether Labour supporters will be too thankful of her liken it to a Thatcher moment, but it was interesting that she was using that sort of language.
Yes, I think that's pretty fascinating, isn't it? And also interesting that you say that, you know, you're wondering a little bit about, you know, whether the Conservatives and Rishi Sunak should fight the general election on the basis of the economy. I mean, the whole point of the Labour strategy thus far too has been very much to court business. And yet, even there, there's been a bit of a backlash against Labour's employment rights plans. You know, some businesses are quite concerned about that.
Yeah, absolutely. My colleague Phil had a great piece about businesses basically warning that Labour's proposals to shake up employment rights will backfire. You know, Labour have, partly to kind of placate some of those MPs on the left of their party, promised a load of reforms that would, you know, include giving employees the right to claim unfair dismissal from their first day on the job, ending zero-hour contracts, bolstering sick pay. You know, these are kind of things that, you know, those MPs in the left party really, really want. But business groups are saying this will backfire. Many firms are looking at ways to get around those changes. But I do wonder whether their bark's worse than their bite on this.
That's our economics reporter, Tom Rees. Thank you very much for joining us.
Now, from the election to another subject, perhaps just as hot button, this is the government setting out to introduce legislation for an independent football regulator in Parliament today. Yes, if football is your passion, this will no doubt have you thinking very hard. It's a bid basically to redistribute revenues from top-tier Premier League clubs to lower English Football League clubs, but also quite a lot more besides in terms of having an independent regulator. For a closer look at this, Bloomberg's UK politics reporter Ellen Milligan is with us. Just tell us about this legislation, what's in it, and sort of why it has come about.
Yeah, this legislation to essentially regulate British football came about from a fan-led football review by the MP Tracy Crouch, who was commissioned to lead this review after the biggest British football clubs tried to break away from English football leagues about 2 years ago. Do you remember the European Super League?
Yeah, the Super League, absolutely.
Which fell apart in about it fell apart in about a week after a massive backlash from fans. But it prompted conversations about whether there was a way to regulate, particularly the Premier League, to prevent that from happening again. Also, we've seen a number of smaller clubs like Bury FC and Macclesfield Town collapse due to not having the financial sustainability to keep afloat. And so the combination of those two things, concerns about the really big clubs and the smaller clubs, led to this legislation. And essentially what it hopes to do is to introduce some basic requirements on corporate governance, financial reporting. There's going to it's going to be able to prevent clubs breaking away into other leagues, for example, the next European Super League, if there is one. And the hope is that it will make the football environment in England more financially sustainable and fairer for fans as well.
Ellen, obviously, there's a general election coming up. Football is very popular. Is this Rishi Sunak trying to score political points and leaving the difficult work of setting up a regulator for Keir Starmer if he were to win?
Well, a little bit of intel for you. My understanding is that Rishi Sunak wasn't personally super sold on the idea. You know, regulation isn't typically something a Conservative Prime Minister wants to introduce. But this is something that has got quite widespread rapport, and the Labour Party supports setting up an independent regulator, for example. Football fans tend to be on the side of giving more financial support to their clubs, redistributing revenue with smaller clubs as well. This legislation is going to give fans more of a say in the kit, the location of a club, for example, of the stadium. And also, ever since this legislation was announced in the King's Speech in November, the Premier League has had an opportunity to do a deal with the English Football League to redistribute its revenues, and has failed to do so for about 5 months now. And last week, the shareholder meeting of Premier League got called off because they recognised they weren't going to get enough support from the clubs to get this deal done. And the next morning, I'm told, Rishi Sunak signed off on this legislation being tabled in Parliament because they have grown so frustrated with waiting for them. And you're right, we're coming up close to an election, but actually, because this bill has quite widespread cross-party support, we could see it passed by the summer recess, end of July, for example. It's not going to be super contentious, other than, I think, with the kind of free marketeer Conservative MPs who probably aren't the biggest football fans. So I think it could be passed within a few months.
So that was Ellen Milligan, Bloomberg's UK political reporter. Thanks to her. So she set up the conversation quite nicely. Let's get a bit of the insider perspective then on what the legislation might mean, what a new regulator for the football industry might mean for the UK, with former Olympian Sky Andrew.
What's going on at the moment is that there are segments of the football community that are just not happy with the way the governing body dealing with certain issues. So there are issues like we've got financial fair play, which is basically a complicated financial law that says that clubs aren't allowed to lose so much money per year. And then you've seen recently that Everton have been deducted points, and that Man City have been charged, and that Nottingham Forest have been deducted some points as well. So what the people on the inside of football are saying is we need an independent regulatory body to deal with these issues. And also we have something called an arbitration, football arbitration in football, where if there's a dispute between two parties, then it goes to an arbitration. The times have shone a light on these arbitrations might not be most stringent way of dealing with issues. So the feeling amongst the football fraternity is that if we have an independent regulatory body, then they will come from the outside and deal with issues that everyone's talking about and that's been on the back pages.
Yeah, that may be possible, but I suppose there's also a question of exactly what the regulators' powers will be. Will they be able to intervene or not? And it's not as if regulators in the UK have really dealt with certain issues, especially ones with big money involved, very well. I mean, I can cite Ofcom, Ofwat, the rail regulator, the ORR. I mean, they've all had massive, you know, issues to deal with. And when it's come down to kind of financial matters, they've not handled them very well. I mean, do you think that an independent regulator is going to be able to answer the questions, as you say, that football has?
Well, I think that the people that are wanting an independent regulator need to be careful what they wish for, because the thing about football is that football, the business of football, is like no other business. And so you almost do need people that understand football and understand the business of football to deal with it and to legislate it. So if an independent regulator comes in, the first challenge they're going to have is, how does the football business work? Now, for instance, the fans know that there's financial fair play, but most fans don't necessarily understand completely what it's about. And the thing with football, and like no other business, is that normally in a business, you want to make profits. And a business is very careful about how they do their income and expenditure. But in football, the fans want the best players. The fans are not really bothered about whether clubs are in the red or whether clubs are losing millions. So, for instance, a club allegedly breaking the financial fair play rules and spending too much money and going into too much debt, for a fan, as long as they're getting the best players and they're winning, you know, they're not really bothered about that. But the governing bodies say, look, we need to have a level playing field, and all of the clubs need to know that they can only spend so much of their budget. They can only lose so much. And that's the big issue, because now the governing body have charged Man City with so many alleged offences, and Man City are winning everything. So there are many people in football that are saying, well, what are the governing bodies going to do about it? And then so that's why people are asking for an independent regulatory body to just come in, look at everything and say, well, if there are any rules that are broken, then they'll just deal with it. Whereas there is a school of thought within the football industry that maybe the governing bodies aren't coming down on the bigger clubs.
It's interesting though, because football is this phenomenally successful UK export. It's, you know, the country's most popular sport, and arguably, and you kind of got to the heart of this with, should it be treated like a business or something that's good for society? Should there be more funding going to smaller clubs? Women's football is a potential opportunity as well. Do the big enough clubs do a good enough job of distributing their success?
I mean, that's another issue, isn't it? I mean, the distribution of wealth in football, you know, is huge. So you've got the bigger clubs, and people talk about Man City because, you know, they're winning everything. And the money that the players earn and the money that the clubs bring in and the wealth of the owners. And then you've got grassroots football where you've got players, you know, having part-time jobs and playing football because they love football. So distribution of wealth, it's something that is always going to be in football, because owning a football club for some people is a vanity project. And if they've got endless amounts of money, then they can come into football and they can buy a club and they can get the best players and they can pay the most money.
But on the specifics of the Premier League, rejecting the £900 million EFL support plan, that that's the specific of it, isn't it? That actually the deal to distribute more of the money down the pyramid has been rejected. And do you think that that's going to change with the threat of a regulator? Maybe a deal would be done.
You see, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, is football has got a huge demand at the highest level. And it's all about demand and supply. And what we have here is that, you know, the broadcasters like Sky and TNT Sports, they're paying billions for the rights for the Premier League. And they're not going to pay billions for the rights of the Championship. Even though the Championship is like the fifth or sixth biggest league in the world, the fact is that no one is going to make this a charity and say, you know what, we need to give the Premier League less money, we need to give more to the Championship, more to League One, more to grassroots, which is what is the general feeling of everybody in football. I'm not just talking about the fans, I'm talking about anyone who watches football will think, do you know what, more money needs to go lower down the food chain. But because of the demand and the desire for people to have the Premier League rights, most of the money is always going to go to the Premier League.
So odds on, Sky, do you reckon there's going to be a deal or no deal? Where would you put it at the moment?
I mean, there are certain issues why we need an independent regulatory body, right? So with arbitrations and disputes within football, I think we need to bring someone else in to actually deal with it. And if we do bring in an independent body, that body needs to be completely impartial, completely rational, and they need to look at every club as the same situation, so that no club is bigger than football. But we do have situations where some clubs, right, they get the biggest figures on TV, they get the biggest amounts of money from TV rights. The demand to watch them is incredible.
Former Olympian Sky Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Mia Dawkins and Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineers were Maruful Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm James Wilcock.
I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.